File 30.
For us Germans, the slogan of internal colonization is fatal, because it encourages the belief that we have discovered a means which is in accordance with our innate pacifism, and which will enable us to work for our livelihood in a half-slumbering existence. Such a teaching, once it were taken seriously by our people, would mean the end of all effort to acquire for ourselves that place in the world which we deserve. If the average German were once convinced that by this means he has the chance of ensuring his livelihood and guaranteeing his future, any attempt to take an active and profitable part in sustaining the vital demands of his country would be out of the question. Should the nation agree to such an attitude, then any really useful foreign policy might be looked upon as dead and buried, together with all hope for the future of the German people. Once we know what the consequences of this internal colonization theory would be, we can no longer consider as a mere accident the fact that among those who inculcate this quite pernicious mentality among our people, the Jew is always in the first line. He knows his softies only too well not to know that they are ready to be the grateful victims of every swindle which promises them a gold block in the shape of a discovery that will enable them to outwit nature and thus render superfluous the hard and inexorable struggle for existence, so that finally they may become lords of the planet partly by sheer dolce far niente, and partly by working when a pleasing opportunity arises. It cannot be too strongly emphasized that any German internal colonization must first of all be considered as suitable only for the relief of social grievances. To carry out a system of internal colonization, the most important preliminary measure would be to free the soil from the grip of the speculator and assure that freedom. But such a system could never suffice to assure the future of the nation without the acquisition of new territory. If we adopt a different plan, we shall soon reach a point beyond which the resources of our soil can no longer be exploited, and at the same time we shall reach a point beyond which our manpower cannot develop. In conclusion, the following must be said. The fact that only up to a limited extent can internal colonization be practiced in a national territory which is of definitely small area, and the restriction of the procreative faculty which follows as a result of such conditions, these two factors have a very unfavorable effect on the military and political standing of a nation. The extent of the national territory is a determining factor in the external security of the nation. The larger the territory which a people has at its disposal, the stronger are the national defences of that people. Military decisions are more quickly, more easily, more completely and more effectively gained against a people occupying a national territory which is restricted in area than against states which have extensive territories. Moreover, the magnitude of a national territory is in itself a certain assurance that an outside power will not hastily risk the adventure of an invasion. For in that case, the struggle would have to be long and exhausting before victory could be hoped for. The risk being so great, there would have to be extraordinary reasons for such an aggressive adventure. Hence it is that the territorial magnitude of a state furnishes a base whereon national liberty and independence can be maintained with relative ease, while, on the contrary, a state whose territory is small, offers a natural temptation to the invader. As a matter of fact, so-called national circles in the German Reich rejected those first two possibilities of establishing a balance between the constant numerical increase in the population and a national territory which could not expand proportionately. But the reasons given for that rejection were different from those which I have just expounded. It was mainly on the basis of certain moral sentiments that restriction of the birth rate was objected to. Proposals for internal colonization were rejected indignantly because it was suspected that such a policy might mean an attack on the big landowners, and that this attack might be the forerunner of a general assault against the principle of private property as a whole. The form in which the latter solution, internal colonization, was recommended justified the misgivings of the big landowners. But the form in which the colonization proposal was rejected was not very clever as regards the impression which such rejection might be calculated to make on the mass of the people. And anyhow, it did not go to the root of the problem at all. Only two further ways were left open, in which work and bread could be secured for the increasing population. 3. It was possible to think of acquiring new territory on which a certain portion of the increasing population could be settled each year, or else, 4. Our industry and commerce had to be organized in such a manner as to secure an increase in the exports and thus be able to support our people by the increased purchasing power accruing from the profits made on foreign markets. Therefore, the problem was a policy of territorial expansion or a colonial and commercial policy. Both policies were taken into consideration, examined, recommended, and rejected from various standpoints, with the result that the second alternative was finally adopted. The sounder alternative, however, was undoubtedly the first. The principle of acquiring new territory, on which the surplus population could be settled, has many advantages to recommend it, especially if we take the future as well as the present into account. In the first place, too much importance cannot be placed on the necessity for adopting a policy which will make it possible to maintain a healthy peasant class as the basis of the national community. Many of our present evils have their origin exclusively in the disproportion between the urban and rural portions of the population. A solid stock of small and medium farmers has at all times been the best protection which a nation could have against the social diseases that are prevalent today. Moreover, that is the only solution which guarantees the daily bread of a nation within the framework of its domestic national economy. With this condition once guaranteed, industry and commerce would retire from the unhealthy position of foremost importance which they hold today, and would take their due place within the general scheme of national economy, adjusting the balance between demand and supply. Thus, industry and commerce would no longer constitute the basis of the national subsistence, but would be auxiliary institutions. By fulfilling their proper function, which is to adjust the balance between national production and national consumption, they render the national subsistence more or less independent of foreign countries, and thus assure the freedom and independence of the nation, especially at critical junctures in its history. Such a territorial policy, however, cannot find its fulfilment in the Cameroons, but almost exclusively here in Europe. One must calmly and squarely face the truth that it certainly cannot be part of the dispensation of divine providence, to give a 50 times larger share of the soil in this world to one nation than to another. In considering this state of affairs today, one must not allow existing political frontiers to distract attention from what ought to exist on principles of strict justice. If this earth has sufficient room for all, then we ought to have that share of the soil which is absolutely necessary for our existence. Of course, people will not voluntarily make that accommodation. At this point, the right of self-preservation comes into effect. And when attempts to settle the difficulty in an amicable way are rejected, the clenched hand must take by force that which was refused to the open hand of friendship. If, in the past, our ancestors had based their political decisions on similar pacifist nonsense as our present generation does, we should not possess more than one-third of the national territory that we possess today, and probably there would be no German nation to worry about its future in Europe. No, we owe the two eastern marks of the empire to the natural determination of our forefathers in their struggle for existence, and thus it is to the same determined policy that we owe the inner strength which is based on the extent of our political and racial territories, and which alone has made it possible for us to exist up to now. And there is still another reason why that solution would have been the correct one. Many contemporary European states are like pyramids standing on their apexes. The European territory which these states possess is ridiculously small when compared with the enormous overhead weight of their colonies, foreign trade, etc. It may be said that they have the apex in Europe and the base of the pyramid all over the world, quite different from the United States of America, which has its base on the American continent and is in contact with the rest of the world only through its apex. Out of that situation arises the incomparable inner strength of the USA, and the contrary situation is responsible for the weakness of most of the colonial European powers. England cannot be suggested as an argument against this assertion, though in glancing casually over the map of the British Empire, one is inclined easily to overlook the existence of a whole Anglo-Saxon world. England's position cannot be compared with that of any other state in Europe, since it forms a vast community of language and culture, together with the USA. Therefore, the only possibility which Germany had of carrying a sound territorial policy into effect was that of acquiring new territory in Europe itself. Colonies cannot serve this purpose as long as they are not suited for settlement by Europeans on a large scale. In the 19th century, it was no longer possible to acquire such colonies by peaceful means. Therefore, any attempt at such a colonial expansion would have meant an enormous military struggle. Consequently, it would have been more practical to undertake that military struggle for new territory in Europe, rather than to wage war for the acquisition of possessions abroad. Such a decision naturally demanded that the nation's undivided energies should be devoted to it. A policy of that kind, which requires for its fulfilment every ounce of available energy on the part of everybody concerned, cannot be carried into effect by half measures or in a hesitating manner. The political leadership of the German Empire should then have been directed exclusively to this goal. No political step should have been taken in response to other considerations than this task and the means of accomplishing it. Germany should have been alive to the fact that such a goal could have been reached only by war, and the prospect of war should have been faced with calm and collected determination. The whole system of alliances should have been envisaged and valued from that standpoint. If new territory were to be acquired in Europe, it must have been mainly at Russia's cost. And once again, the new German Empire should have set out on its march along the same road as was formerly trodden by the Teutonic Knights, this time to acquire soil for the German plough by means of the German sword, and thus provide the nation with its daily bread. For such a policy, however, there was only one possible ally in Europe, and that was England.